We are in Mark's Gospel today, the 8th chapter, starting with verse 27. Jesus went on with his disciples to the villages of Caesarea Philippi. And on the way, he asked his disciples, "Who do people say that I am?" And they answered him, "John the Baptist, and others Elijah, and still others, one of the prophets." He asked them, "But who do you say that I am?" Peter answered him, "You are the Messiah." And he sternly ordered them not to tell anyone about him. Then he began to teach them that the Son of Man must undergo great suffering and be rejected by the elders, the chief priests, and the scribes, and be killed, and after 3 days rise again. He said all of this quite openly. And Peter took him aside and began to rebuke him. You would think at some point Peter would learn better. But turning and looking at his disciples, he rebuked Peter and said, "Get behind me, Satan, for you are setting your mind not on divine things, but on human things." He called the crowd with his disciples and said to them, "If any want to become my followers, let them deny themselves and take up their cross and follow me. For those who want to save their life will lose it, and those who lose their life for my sake and for the sake of the gospel will save it. For what will it profit them to gain the whole world and forfeit their life? Indeed, what can they give in return for their life? Those who are ashamed of me and of my words in this adulterous and sinful generation, of them the Son of Man will also be ashamed when he comes in the glory of his Father with the holy angels." This is the word of the Lord.
Thanks be to God.
Would you join me again silently in prayer? Gracious God, as always, it is my prayer in the following moments that more and more be seen of you and less of me. Amen. There is, in the midst of Mark's gospel, a couple things going on here. There's a narrative tension that has been building from the beginning of the gospel, and there's also a shift that happens. If you kind of do the math, this is almost exactly the midpoint of Mark's gospel. In the very first verse of Mark's gospel, we are told this is the beginning of the good news of Jesus Christ, the Son of God. So we, the readers, know right off the bat who Jesus is. The disciples, however, are taking a little longer to figure it out. In chapter 4, they actually ask, "Who is this?" In chapter 6, they mistake Jesus for a ghost. And commentators will tell you that there's some deliberateness in the way this is going. It kind of builds irony, first of all, that we know what's going on, and the disciples who spend all of their time with Jesus do not. But it also builds a little bit of tension in the text. But now, with this passage today, everyone gets on the same page. And another thing that's worth mentioning as far as this shift goes is up until this point, through the first 7 chapters of Mark, we haven't really had any indication of Messiah, so to speak, and how Jesus' life is going to end. That, of course, changes as well. As it says in the text, Jesus is quite open and honest about what the end of his life is going to look like. So this little passage or this little story marks a turn or a shift in the gospel. Jesus has been teaching and preaching throughout Galilee, and now he kind of turns his eyes, so to speak, to the cross. It's a pivot point, and Mark's gospel is kind of known as the action gospel as well. Jesus is going places, he's doing things. And one commentator even made the point that from here on, it's almost like a sprint, so to speak, to the cross and the end of Jesus' life. So that's important to know as we dig into this text. I don't know about you, but occasionally when I go to prepare sermons, well, that doesn't make any sense because you all don't prepare sermons regularly. I don't know about you, But sometimes when I read the scripture, I get questions. And that actually will guide me as I go to prepare a sermon if I have a question about something. And so when I was doing that this week, I thought about this little phrase in here. He sternly ordered them not to tell anyone about him. And on the surface, it didn't make sense to me necessarily, because here there are these people that have been following around and they finally figured it out, right? And Peter's given the right answer. And Jesus' response is, don't tell anybody. It didn't seem to make sense. So when I was reading, here's one thing that was put forward that kind of made sense to me. I mentioned already, of course, how the disciples have mislabeled Jesus. And in this passage that I read this morning, when he asked what other people have said, they've named him as John the Baptist or Elijah or even one of the other prophets. And when Peter answers the Messiah, we, of course, know the ending, right? We know what that means, and Jesus kind of talks about it in a minute. But at that point, Messiah means something different, right? Messiah is the person who is going to come in and fight a battle and overthrow the Romans and restore, and that's not actually who Jesus is. And so maybe Jesus says, don't tell anyone, because he knows, having spent all of his time with these folks, that even though they're starting to catch on, that they still don't totally get it. They still don't fully understand who Jesus is. Their idea of a Messiah and Jesus' idea of a Messiah, who he actually is different, which is why Jesus explains it in the verses following. Who do you say that I am? I would start by saying, if somebody asked you that question, think about how you would answer it. Who would you say Jesus is? That's a worthy thought exercise in this reading this text and thinking about this text. I would say, broadly speaking, and this isn't any less true at times of pastors, in some ways we tend to tame Jesus. In some ways we make Jesus over into our own image. Part of, and you've heard me mention this before, but part of the what I would label the sin or fallacy of Christian nationalism that's going on in this country right now is people remaking Jesus in their image or what they think Jesus is or should be. It's a human thing, but I would say to you that it's worth thinking about the answer to this question because it really matters. And the reason it really matters is because Jesus' identity shapes our identity, ideally speaking. Because, right, that's what being a disciple means. You are embarking on a lifelong journey, hopefully, of allowing Jesus' identity to shape your own. Very rarely do we just get it and everything is fine, right? Again, I always say this, lifelong journey. We are constantly growing and learning and changing and doing all the things as we experience what life has to offer, and we view that through our faith lens. But being a disciple means that we are viewing things through that faith lens. So who do you say that Jesus is? Because you can't really answer that question without revealing something about yourself. Who you say Jesus is partly who you have decided to be. Or a commentator said this, and I found it interesting. You could switch that. Who you are reveals who you have decided Jesus is. Jesus' question is not a test. It's not about getting the answer right. It's the moment when you come face to face with your own commitment, your own discipleship, your own identity. It's the moment when you have to admit to what extent how you follow Jesus actually connects with some sort of confession of who you believe Jesus to be. So in light of all that, I ask you to think again how you would answer the question, who do you say Jesus is? Part of the answer to that, of course, comes in verses 34 through 37. That tells us a little bit about what the shape of that life is. And part of that is at times we should be denying ourselves, not as martyrs, but as people who love our neighbors. Again, Jesus says multiple times throughout the Gospels, love God, love your neighbors. Those two things are hand in hand. You can't separate them out. Here's another answer from a commentator about how you might answer that question. Jesus points to a God who meets us in vulnerability, suffering and loss, right? That's part of what Jesus is experiencing in his death. A God who meets us in the moments when we realize we really need God, when everything we worked for, hoped for, had striven for falls apart, and we realize that we are, quite simply, mortal, incapable of saving ourselves, and desperately in need of a God who meets us where we are. Jesus' identity proves elusive because God shows up where we least expect God to be sometimes, which means that sometimes we don't get the God that we want, but instead we get the God that we need. I would encourage you to continue to think about that question and talk to somebody following the service. How would you say who Jesus is? I want to then transition to this second statement that Jesus makes, the question. He asks, and then the question is, if any want to become my followers, let them deny themselves and take up their cross and follow me. And I want to approach it from two ways. The first thing I want to talk about is what it doesn't mean, because I think this is one of those passages in the Bible that gets misused or shaped again for people and their agendas. This passage does not mean, it does not mean that you are to stay in a suffering or an abusive relationship. And it's been used for that. I personally have heard stories of people who have gone to pastors with a problem in their life, in particular a marriage kind of situation, and been told, well, you know, you have to carry your cross. And particularly in cases of abuse, that's nonsense. God does not want anybody to consistently suffer abuse for any reason. It's not scriptural. The words, take up your cross, can unfortunately be used as a powerful tool of abuse. It doesn't mean that we need to completely abandon the language, but we have to be careful and understand the ways that even Jesus' words at times have been used for evil purposes. This passage does not mean that we are all called to be martyrs. I was reflecting and thinking, there's some emotion tied up in this, and I think I've told this story before, but, you know, we pastors repeat things. At one point, I was invited to go to a high school here in Richmond and speak to the Fellowship of Christian Athletes, and I did that, and I actually talked about the parable of the prodigal son because it's one of my favorites, and I went through it, and, you know, I could tell some of the kids were kind of checked out, but that's just the way kids are. But it's funny, afterwards, I was talking to the guy who invited me, thank you, and I heard one of the kids saying to another kid, like, well, we're going to invite this person next week. He was on drugs. It is that sense, right, of martyrdom. I'm a better Christian because I've suffered more. Unfortunately, that's the way at times this passage has been used. That's not what this passage means. Self-denial doesn't mean seeking or embracing abuse for the sake of it, as if somehow suffering is redemptive or a mark of virtue. We go through things that are difficult. It does, I think, help us in the sense of understanding that when we get through the other side, or even when we're in the midst of it, that God never leaves us. But we don't seek it out just to see if God is there. And we certainly don't seek it out because we think God will be with us more than not. Jesus, by the way, spent 7 chapters going around in this gospel, and of course in others, alleviating needless suffering or oppression whenever he encounters it. So how much sense does it make that he would then turn around and say, no, I want you to suffer on purpose, if he's been doing the opposite of that for 7 chapters? We have to be careful not to allow this text to perpetuate or excuse martyrdom or victimization. One other point to make that this passage does not mean or does not say is that Jesus suffers and dies because suffering is good. The necessity of suffering for Jesus comes from the way that Jesus chooses to live. A series of actions that do not conform to social and religious norms, a life that reaches out to people that other people don't think are worth it, right? Those who are ostracized, those who are unclean, or those who are marginalized. The suffering comes as a product of that. It's not the goal. And so Jesus is not saying, oh my gosh, here's where I'm headed. It is a consequence, so to speak, of the life that he chooses to live and the mission that he is on, so to speak, from God. So if it doesn't mean any of those things, what does it mean? Well, Jesus talks about losing our lives for his sake and for the sake of the gospel. Taking up our cross means that if we follow Jesus faithfully, whatever happens, happens. It means lining up our priorities, ideally, with Jesus' priorities. It means being willing to lose our lives or part of our lives by losing it for others. Using our time, our resources, our gifts, our energy, so that others might also experience God's love made known in Jesus Christ. That's part of what that giving up means. Jesus calls us to separate ourselves from what defines us. So we've talked about this before. A person in Jesus' culture was often defined, or mostly defined, by who they belonged, right? Their household, their kin, it was a very, you know, that much in that society. And so Jesus is calling people to embrace new understandings of identity. That's part of what it means. Well, what does that mean for us? What or who or what or how are you defined? If somebody, there's this exercise that I've heard before, where you ask somebody, hey, tell me about yourself, or who are you? And at what point does Christian enter that description? Now, that's not some sort of test, like if you don't say Christian within the first five answers that you're a bad person. But if you're giving that answer and Christian is nowhere in it, then that's partly what Jesus is talking about here. So often, I think, of course, that we are defined in our world still, sometimes by family. Certainly there is a thing in our society where we are defined by what we do, right? Whatever work is our identity. And that's not to say we can't be invested in work or that it's not important. But part of what Jesus is talking about, again, is priorities and how we define ourselves. So I would ask you, what gives you the greatest joy in life? What creates for you the deepest sense of purpose? When do you feel most alive, most true to the person you believe God created you to be? Self-denial and cross-bearing are not about being less happy, but about discovering who God created you to be. You've heard me mention Frederick Buechner any number of times from this pulpit, and you've heard me mention this phrase, and I'll say it again, his comment on vocation. The place where your deep gladness and the world's deep hunger meet. Your deep gladness is the call of your true, enduring, and authentic self, and the pursuits that engender, not necessarily always happiness, but profound joy. How are you seeking joy in your life? And not just how are you seeking joy in your life, how are you seeking joy in your life through the lens of who you believe God created you to be? That's part of what this text means. Part of also what this text means is to deny yourself and take up your cross is not just about death and suffering, but it's about God choosing us, right? God choosing human relationships. You've heard me mention before, to me, part of the way that we read the Bible from beginning to end is it is a constant story of how God makes creation and then never gives up on it. Never ever, no matter what creation does, no matter how many times God says, do this or don't do this, and creation does the opposite, God never ever gives up. So part of what is going on in here is God choosing us yet again. The cross represents God's commitment to us. The cross also can represent what we do when we are not in relationship with someone else or the other and think only for ourselves. Because Christian or not, we are all in this world together. The cross can represent what we do when we are not in relationship with others, the way we should be, and think only for ourselves, because again, Christian or not, we all live in this world together. One commentator said, because each and every time we make ourselves vulnerable to the needs of those around us, each time we give ourselves in love to another person, each time we get out of our own way and seek not what we want, but what the world needs, we come alive. We are uplifted. We experience the glory of God made manifest. So I'm going to end. I'm going to end this message with a thought exercise and a challenge along the lines of just what I've been talking about. So the first thought exercise is this. Think about the last day, the last week recently in your life. Think about an example of when you experience the kind of strange love and glory that comes from sacrifice. Maybe it was stopping to help somebody in need. Maybe it was making a donation to a charitable cause. Perhaps it was sticking up for somebody else who needed to be stuck up for. Perhaps it was delaying some sort of gratification to yourself in order to help somebody else's needs. Maybe it was listening to somebody. Maybe it was sharing a smile or a hug. Maybe it was ... fill in the blank here. So I'm gonna look at my watch here, and I'm going to give you 30 seconds to reflect on that. Where in the previous week did you experience that kind of joy and gladness? The challenge that I will leave you with, of course, is the same thing. How will you experience that again when you leave this sanctuary? How can you deliberately be in harmony with who you think God created you to be, not just for the benefit of yourself, but for the benefit of others? I challenge you to think about that now and when you leave this place, and to actually, again, take up your cross and think about that challenge and live that out. Amen.